Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Raising big money is a relatively new phenomenon in academia. How did science, government, and industry get so entrenched with one another? And what has it meant for scholarly research? Michael Hiltzik joins us to talk about his latest book, Big Science: Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Michael Hiltzik. It is great to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm curious first why you decided to do this particular book. It seems like a departure from your past books and subjects. Why Big Science?
Well, it's a departure from some of my recent books, but not necessarily from my trend line. A number of things came together at just the right moment. First, of course, I was looking for a new subject. I had just finished and published a book on the New Deal. I've always been interested in technology and science, and I've always had sort of a hobbyist interest in things like physics and quantum mechanics and things like that. And when you read enough in that field, it isn't long before you encounter the name of Ernest Lawrence. And that's also true when, as I was doing, you cover higher education in the U.S., because higher education means a lot of money being spent on big scientific projects, and he was the father of that trend. So he's often mentioned both as the father of, as I said, big science, but also as the father of modern physics because of his invention of the cyclotron. So this was going to enable me to write about the politics of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and the war, and physics, and technology, and to revive interest and knowledge about this very important scientific figure in the U.S. that most people had really forgotten about.
One of the things that was really remarkable was essentially Lawrence's role in transforming science from what you call small science to what we now call big science. Can you talk about the difference in what it was before Lawrence and then what we are talking about when we say big science?
Sure. Well, there was a continuum of how scientific research, particularly in chemistry and physics, was being done, and especially in physics at the time. We're talking about the very late 20s and the beginning of the 30s. And the older generation of physicists, these are people like Sir Ernest Rutherford and Marie Curie, had accomplished incredible things with the tools that nature gave them. They were using alpha ray emissions from thimblefuls of radium and other radioactive materials, and using those tools, they had discovered radioactivity and X-rays, and they had discovered the neutron, and they had figured out the internal structure of the atom itself. But they also understood that they had basically come to the end of that process, that to delve further into the atomic nucleus, they were going to need projectiles and tools of much greater energies, and that those were not going to be available from natural minerals, that it was going to require using man's ingenuity to build up those energies. And it was Rutherford himself who said, I would like to see an apparatus that can give me 10 electron volts and yet fit in a comfortably sized room. So he sort of set out that challenge to the younger generation, and Lawrence was there at the right moment. He had the right intuitions and the right instinct, and he discovered the way to do that, and that was the cyclotron. It was a way of placing energies on the projectile, in his case, initially protons, and driving them to higher energies without trying to put the energy onto the apparatus itself. And this was a really radical new concept, and he was able to put it into action.
The original cyclotron was really small compared to what it developed into. Tell us a little about what the cyclotron did, the size of it, and then its future, like the Hadron Collider, for example. So walk us through what it did and its size and then its progeny.
Sure. The cyclotron concept was based on the fact that if you send a charged particle through a magnetic field, its path will curve. So Lawrence understood that if you send a proton, which has a positive charge of 1, through a magnetic field, you can twist it into a spiral, and that allows you to jolt it with new energies every time it crosses the same electrode gap. Now, that was the concept. It took a couple of years for him to actually get it to work, and his first cyclotron fit in the palm of his hand. It looked like a flask, a glass or metal flask that had been run over by a truck. It was slathered with red sealing wax to keep a vacuum inside it, and it cost less than $100 in material. Once he got that or its next generations working, every time he got new energies, he raised new questions about what these could do. So every generation of the cyclotron had to be bigger, it had to be more powerful. Inevitably, it was more expensive, and over a period of really less than a decade, he had gone from that little palm-sized unit to a cyclotron that needed a building to be built for it in a ravine above the Berkeley campus, and that was going to cost more than $1 million. This, of course, was a process that soon outstripped the ability of a university to pay for, even a consortium of universities, and that's why Lawrence began to turn to research foundations and the government and eventually industry as well. And that's how big science came about. Forward to the present day, the Large Hadron Collider is the largest atom smasher in the world. It occupies a tunnel that's 17 miles in circumference. It's buried under the border between France and Switzerland, and it costs $9 billion to build. And what it's got in it is several cyclotrons and synchrocyclotrons and other offspring of Lawrence's original concept. So you can see sort of the evolution of these machines over time.
The Large Hadron Collider is really the essence of big, which you noted in your book, titled Big Science, of course, that took, what, 25 years, I think you said, $10 billion. How can we understand just how big this really is?
Well, I think we can understand it by, there's actually a photograph in my book of a man standing inside the tunnel of the Large Hadron Collider, and of course he's dwarfed by the machinery around him, and you compare that to a unit that fit in the palm of somebody's hand. And of course, the energies that these devices can produce today are unimaginable. They were even unimaginable to somebody with the imagination of an Ernest Lawrence, who himself was thinking way ahead of his own contemporaries. But you now need those energies to essentially create or to see at least the signs of new particles that are themselves the building block of subatomic particles and the atom and the world we live in.
I think one of the most important results that we saw from Lawrence was, as you mentioned, the military-industrial complex, the bombs, the World War II, but also the academy. He was the first to really go after all this money and convince the government to put its resources into science, and then the development of big science as an institution in of itself. So I wonder if we could walk through each of these. Perhaps we should start with, you mentioned the first time a scientist had started going to foundations, going to the government. Tell us a little bit about how he did this and how it developed into today.
Yeah, I think that scientific research was sort of lucky in having a person like Lawrence in that place at that time. His personality really lent itself to this sort of, to being an impresario, to being a ringleader and a manager. He was a prototypical CEO of a research center. He was amiable. He was smart. He knew how to talk to university presidents and foundation chairmen and industrial CEOs very easily. It may have had a lot to do with his upbringing as a small-town boy in rural South Dakota. He was very American. He had an air about him that was very different from the stern European mien of physicists of the past. So his personality really lent itself to his ability to do that. And, of course, he had this other quality, which is that when he promised that he would achieve something, he almost always delivered on that promise. So if he was going to the Rockefeller Foundation or the Macy Foundation, which was doing a lot of funding of medical research, and he could say, look, you know, this is my goal, this is what I'm going to do. They could look at his record, and they could see that he actually had achieved what he had promised the last time around. And, you know, he was somebody who always had the next machine on the drawing board when the last one was still being built. So he brought these people along with him. His enthusiasm was really infectious. And, of course, the fact that he actually could deliver was very, very important at this stage when he's out there on the very leading edge of physics. Now, the point came when the needs for his technology really went beyond even what foundations could do, what corporations could do. And at that moment, we were about to enter the war, and the government was in the mode of becoming the most important patron of basic scientific research. And there was Lawrence. He was very friendly with the scientific leadership of the government at the time, and he moved very smoothly into the patronage of the government from industry and foundations and universities.
I got the sense from reading your book that this kind of raised eyebrows at the time, that a lot of scientists weren't really comfortable with this cozy kind of relationship and their concerns about strings attached. What are the ethical concerns that were raised at the time, and integrate them into what you see today?
There was sort of a series of phases. You have to remember that when this process really began, first of all, when he was dealing with universities and foundations, there weren't a lot of ethical concerns raised by other scientists. They understood that these were entities devoted to basic science. They were willing to allow the scientists that they were funding to follow their own noses. At the point that he began to get involved with the military, we were entering the war, and most of the scientific community, particularly the physics community, was very interested in doing this sort of work because a lot of them had come from Germany and Austria. They were very, very panicky about the thought that Hitler would get his hands on the secrets of nuclear fission and create a bomb that they knew was at least plausible and feasible. So at the point that Lawrence began to develop his relationship with the government and the military, the rest of the scientific community was okay with that. They had a job to do. It was an urgent job, and Lawrence helped organize the Manhattan Project. He played a key role in the scientific management of that project. And I think most of his colleagues had faith that he knew what he was doing and that he would protect them from political interference, and he did. Now, that became harder to do in the post-war period when many of the scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project began to have second thoughts about the work they had done, no matter how urgent and important they thought it was at the time, and especially once the U.S. government began to get very interested in the hydrogen bomb. This was a new technology. Many of the physicists who had worked on the atomic bomb were very uncomfortable with it. They viewed it as a weapon that would be good only for genocide or as a psychological menace. Many of them did not want to work on it, but it was Lawrence who kept pushing it ahead. And that, I think, led to a lot of doubts about the propriety of working with Lawrence and with the government at that time. The government in the post-war years was much more interested in attaching strings to its patronage. A lot of physicists who wanted to move back into civilian life were very uncomfortable with that. So you began to see this real split within the scientific community about these relationships, really starting after 1945.
There were some problems, of course, too, in his science. He got sort of busted at one of the conferences that dealt with the deuteron and having contaminated the results. What did that mean in this big picture?
We're going back to the 1930s now, and this was a period in which Lawrence himself was sort of learning how to be a scientist. I think it's something that many scientists have to go through. They have to learn how to divorce their thrill with the technology that they have on hand from the need to actually come up with results. Lawrence and his team at Berkeley in the early days, they were really focused on building up the technology, on building bigger cyclotrons that were more and more capable. And in that era, actual scientific research often took a back seat to this desire to build the machine. As I said, in the radiation lab, which was Lawrence's lab at Berkeley, you could be forgiven for not bringing a scientific project to fruition, but you could not be forgiven for missing your shift tending the cyclotron. A lot of scientists just, you know, could not deal with that. He lost a few very talented men, but many saw that once the cyclotron was perfected, the ability to do research would be great. But in the process, Lawrence got a lot of things wrong. His team missed a couple of very important developments. They missed the discovery of artificial radiation, which was discovered by Marie Curie, even though they had the best equipment to make this discovery. And the deuteron affair, which you just mentioned, involved what Lawrence thought was his discovery of what was going on when a deuteron, that's the nucleus of a helium atom, strikes a target within the cyclotron. He used his findings to develop a theory about the weight of the neutron, which other scientists, much more experienced scientists, especially at Cambridge University in England, thought was wrong. And then he presented his results at a very important scientific conference in Brussels, and he was shown to be wrong. He had to climb down. His reputation was really at risk because experienced researchers thought that he had been incompetent in doing this. He had tried to claim results that were not supported by the data. And I think he learned a lot from that. He learned humility, certainly, and he learned really the need to do the actual research much more rigorously. And that, I think, was a turning point for his lab. And after that, they didn't make that mistake again.
So let's bring in Oppenheimer now. He was, as you described, the great theorist, whereas Lawrence was a great experimentalist. So we're fast forwarding now. You said their relationship was quite enigmatic, but also probably the most responsible for developing big science. How would you describe that relationship before Oppenheimer got into some trouble?
Robert Oppenheimer got to Berkeley a year or so after Ernest did, and as you said, Oppenheimer was probably the most talented physics theorist in the United States at the time. Lawrence's grasp of theory was not always very strong, but he was a great experimentalist, and of course Oppenheimer was useless around a machine. So they had a symbiotic relationship. They had a great relationship. And at the beginning of this time, they were very, very close friends. Lawrence's first son, Robert, was named after Oppenheimer. The family socialized together. They were very, very close. But they were very different. And in fact, a lot of their colleagues spent half their lives trying to figure out what drew Ernest Lawrence and Robert Oppenheimer together, and then spent half their lives trying to figure out what led to their very, very bitter breakup later in their lives. As you said, it was an odd relationship. Started out very warm. It ended very bitter. But at the key moments from the 1930s and into the 1940s, it was very, very close. In fact, it was Lawrence who nominated Oppenheimer to run the lab that would become Los Alamos under the Manhattan Project. And he even had to vouch for Oppenheimer when the U.S. Army said, you know, Oppenheimer's a leftist. We're not sure he's not a communist. It was Lawrence who stepped forward and said, I will keep him under control. If he runs off the rails, I will be there to fix it. And that was enough for General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, to basically sign off on Oppenheimer's appointment.
Eventually, his security clearance was revoked, Oppenheimer's. So what happened for the revocation to occur?
Well, that's the tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer. After the war, he not only opposed the development of the hydrogen bomb, but he spoke out against it. He became a great campaigner against nuclear proliferation and the development of thermonuclear weapons, and of course a very respected one because of his role in the war. He had been sort of a shy, mumbling figure at the beginning of the 30s when he and Lawrence first began their friendship, and he had developed into essentially a world figure, world-famous physicist, scientist, and statesman. Now, in opposing the hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer ran afoul of a man named Louis Strauss, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission under Truman and Eisenhower, and was a fanatic fan of developing the hydrogen bomb. Strauss was the type of person who, if you disagreed with him, he at first thought you were an idiot and then concluded you were a traitor, and that's the way he viewed Oppenheimer. So it was Strauss who really started this campaign to revoke Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance and staged essentially a trial of Oppenheimer to revoke that clearance, in which physicists of great renown from all over the country essentially had to take sides, either for Oppenheimer or against him. The real tragedy in this relationship, I think, is that almost every physicist in the U.S., certainly every physicist who had worked in the Manhattan Project, was on Oppenheimer's side and defended him at this trial. The only people who were against him were Ernest Lawrence and his team at Berkeley. And they came very close to testifying at this procedure against Oppenheimer, and then decided that it was better for them if they just stood down and they didn't testify at all.
So do you think ultimately it was politics that divided Lawrence and Oppenheimer?
It was chiefly politics, but I think their personalities and their different lifestyles really played into this and played an important role. I think if they had political disagreements, but they were two different people than they were, I don't think it would have been as bitter a breakup as it became. You have to really think about how fundamentally different in personality these two people were. Lawrence, as I said, was a small town boy. He was married to the same woman all his life. Robert Oppenheimer was a New Yorker, a New York City born and bred. He had been trained in Europe. He had gotten an education of a sophistication that Lawrence didn't have. He was sort of a boulevardier. He was a womanizer. He was married twice. He had a lot of affairs, including one with the wife of a very close friend of Lawrence that Lawrence thought very bitterly about. So you had all these elements. Oppenheimer was into politics. Lawrence tried to stay away from politics as much as he could, especially the sort of leftist socialist politics that Oppenheimer espoused. So you had all these elements, and when you add onto it this fundamental disagreement about a project that Lawrence was committed to and that Oppenheimer was publicly speaking out against, it was an explosive formula, and it really did end in serious breach.
Let's talk also about Lawrence's influence on medicine with his brother and with Harvey Williams Cushing. They really contributed a lot to this field of nuclear medicine. Tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things came together. First of all, Ernest was very sensitive to waves of funding in the scientific community. There was a period early in the development of the cyclotron when funding for hard physics was drying up. This is foundation funding. But funding for medical research was surging. Now, Ernest Lawrence was always on the lookout for patronage. He needed a lot of money to build his machine. So he began to think harder about what the cyclotron could do, what the technology could do for medical science. Now, his younger brother, John, was a medical doctor who was also interested in this field. So they came together and they worked together to develop what became the field of nuclear medicine. John Lawrence was one of the first professors of nuclear medicine. He got the appointment at the University of California at what was then Berkeley's Medical School, which was in San Francisco, which is now UC San Francisco. And they worked together to develop the capabilities of using radiation to diagnose and cure disease in ways that are still being used today. A lot of the machines, diagnostic equipment that's used today was pioneered by Ernest and John Lawrence at this very, very early stage. At the same time, Ernest was beginning to use the cyclotron to develop new isotopes that were not seen in the natural world, that he could create by bombarding existing elements. Some of these became very important diagnostic and curative tools in medicine as well.
You opened your book talking about the Higgs boson and how it has come out of big science. If you were going to say the other really big contributions that have come from this, essentially from this guy who transformed science and wedded it with government and big foundations, what would you say the other big contributions have been?
Well, I'd say if you look around, big science is all around us. It was critical in developing not only nuclear science, but also advances in biology. The Human Genome Project, that's a big science project. Addressing climate change, that's going to require big science. If we define big science as capital-intensive interdisciplinary research at a very basic level, then you can see that there's so much around us that depends on this paradigm. But at the same time, of course, it unleashed the destructive force of the nucleus as well. So I quoted in my book Raymond Fosdick, who was the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, who funded Ernest's largest cyclotron. This was in the late 1930s and early 1940s, who said, "We can't say science itself is good or evil. We can only talk about what humankind makes of this knowledge and these achievements." And I think that's the way we have to look at big science. It really, as I also quoted James Franck, who was a German emigre physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and who knew Lorentz and who knew all this technology, he said, look, what we have done with big science is we have brought science past the point in which scientists can any longer disavow responsibility for their discoveries. There's just too much at stake. The destructive power of what we have discovered is greater than all the discoveries of mankind put together in the past. So I think big science has brought science to that point where scientists have to think about what the implications are of what they do. And this is very difficult both for science and for society at large, and I'm not sure we have solved that problem yet. But all we can say is that it's big science that still fulfills man's undying quest for knowledge in ever more important ways.
And it's also transformed the academy itself.
Well, it definitely has. The need to raise money, to marshal resources, and to manage these huge teams and huge funds really has turned university professors and university presidents into impresarios and promoters and CEOs. It's taken them away from the work of actually doing science in a way that I think has made many people uncomfortable, and rightly so. But I think that trend is only going to continue because big science itself drives its leaders to raise more money and build more to make science ever bigger, to answer ever bigger questions.
Michael Hiltzik, thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm happy to be here.
Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of 6 books, including the one we've been talking about, Big Science, Ernest Lorentz, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex.